Hello and welcome to Issues and Ideas. Coming up on today's program, Marisa Waddell talks with Ron Rasmussen, chair of the Small Wilderness Area Preservation. It's a group of dedicated volunteers that work hard at the long-term management and restoration of the Elfin Forest in Los Osos. Also on the program, Ears on Art presents its 14th annual holiday program featuring stories told by community members. But up first, correspondent Tom Wilmer visits with Walter Heath about the Morro Bay in Bloom Volunteer Project, a program founded on the concept that a small group of people applying 2 hours of effort every week can make a positive difference in their community.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from the harborfront in Morro Bay, California. Right now we're with Walter Heath, the director of Morro Bay in Bloom. Hi, Walter.
Hi, Tom. Good to see you.
You too. Morro Bay in Bloom. How did it start and what's its mission?
Morro Bay in Bloom is built around the idea that a small group of people can accomplish so much in 2 hours on a given Saturday. And if you sustain that effort weekly, you can make a big difference in your community. And so we're doing civic beautification projects here in Morro Bay. And that's how we got our start.
And how did it happen? Was it you going, gee, wouldn't it be nice if? What made it happen?
Well, what made it happen was the mayor of Arroyo Grande, Tony Ferrara, approached our mayor, Jamie Irons, and about the idea of doing what Arroyo Grande has done. And Arroyo Grande is affiliated with the In Bloom, America In Bloom project nationally, and they've been doing it for 7 years, and it's been tremendously successful. So Mayor Ferrara champions the idea to other communities, and Mayor Irons thought it was a good idea for us to get started. He approached me, and we've gone from there.
So there's Morro Bay Parks Department, and there's maintenance departments and whatnot. And was it because there was a gap?
No, actually, Morro Bay is in a beautiful natural setting, and our parks are wonderful as well. It's just that, you know, living in a marine environment where the beach and the dunes are always trying to encroach on the city, a lot of our public spaces have kind of taken on that natural look. And so it takes some ongoing maintenance, some ongoing care to hit these small areas that aren't exactly parks, but, you know, medians and the gateways to town and that sort of thing, to spiff those up and to make those look attractive so that they're not taken over and become like dune spaces.
Give us an example. I know I've received emails about your work parties in the last few weeks and one coming up next weekend.
Yes. Well, you know, the landscaping around some of our infrastructure, which was built in the 1950s, is starting to show its age. And so we initially adopted the Morro Bay Library. Our library is going to be undergoing an interior renovation in 2014. And we thought, well, this would be the perfect opportunity to call attention to that fact. The library is an anchor in downtown, and everybody loves it. We get between 400 to 600 unique visits to our library every day, and so we decided it was time to spiff up that landscaping, and the head librarian agreed, the county, which maintains the landscaping around the library, agreed, and so we're working on that. We're also working on the Morro Bay Chamber of Commerce to spiff that up, since it's such a visible symbol of our town, and we recently adopted the Centennial Park stairway and area. That's the chessboard park near the harbor that a lot of people have seen with the giant chessboard and the pieces there. So we have three project sites, and we're looking to acquire a couple more in 2014 that we will spruce up and then maintain.
It's one thing to do weeding and hoeing and pruning. Do you also go to the next level and put in plantings? And if so, where do they come from?
Yes, absolutely. And we absolutely do the planting. We tend to plant natives. We do plant some accent coloring, some accent color there too. But it's surprising how much color there is in some of the native plants. So we have a landscaping consultant who's one of our key volunteers. And we're looking to work with master gardeners in the area to help us with that. But the Parks Department is our partner, and the Recreation and Parks Department here in Morro Bay. So they are our partner. And so we work with them to acquire plant materials and to go ahead and install them. In some cases, we go ahead and purchase some things on our own. And depending upon what the client need is and how soon we need them.
And I presume it's a no-brainer to try and stay within the realm of xeriscaping with low water demand plants.
Yes, absolutely. One of the things that we look at in choosing a project site is the status of irrigation there. And if there's irrigation already in place, it's great because then we don't have to do that. But if there's a situation where the system is not the space is not currently on an irrigated system, then we'll go ahead and try to install some water saving system, a drip irrigation system usually.
You talked about purchasing plants. Where does the money come from to buy the plants?
Well, contributions from folks in the community, and we're an incipient organization, so we've just been getting started, and the way we chose to start was to just start doing projects, but fundraising will be coming along, and we'll reach out. We have good relations with the Chamber of Commerce here in Morro Bay, and we're going to start to reach out to the business community as they start to see the difference that we're making in Morro Bay.
Give us an example of who has stepped up to the plate and who are your volunteers and where do they come from and why?
Well, our volunteers come from many different backgrounds and all different ages and all different physical abilities. It's surprising, you know, passers-by who have seen us working at the library or next door at the Chamber of Commerce have come up to us and say, well, what are you doing and how can I get involved? So we're reaching out to schools. We're reaching out to the service clubs. We're reaching out to people of all backgrounds because our projects are suited to all levels of ability.
Let's loop back to the big picture in the genesis, and you talked about the In Bloom being a nationwide movement. Tell us about the bigger picture and how this here in Morro Bay could serve as a model for other communities, not only on the Central Coast, but broader.
Sure, I'd be happy to. America in Bloom is a national organization that's based in Ohio, and what they offer to communities is the ability to have your community evaluated by a panel of three experts who come out, visit your community, and evaluate based on eight criteria: the landscaping of public spaces, your urban forestry program and whether you have a tree inventory, the tidiness of the town, whether the landscaping is maintained, how environmentally sustainable it is, going back to the water thriftiness and that sort of thing, the correct choices of plants. They're also looking at floral displays and surprisingly heritage awareness, the extent to which the history of the town is being preserved. And so at the end of that evaluation, you get a written report, which is every bit as good, I'm told, as what you could pay for from a consultant. And that is your template to continue working on the second year.
And there's no cost for this analysis?
Well, there is. There is a registration fee, and we recently, you know, paid our registration fee. It's based on population size.
And how much did that cost?
Well, their fee is the fee for, and our population category is about $1,000, just shy of $1,000. But Arroyo Grande passed through the referral fee to us so that we were able to pay a reduced fee, a reduced registration fee of about $750. That just pays for the administrative work that America in Bloom does to line up the judges, make their travel arrangements, and all that sort of thing, and I guess and eventually print the report, that sort of stuff. So we were able to raise $750. We just sent that in last week.
You sent Royal Grande a few minutes ago.
Yes, and actually, as I say, the mayor of Arroyo Grande champions this program to other communities in our area, and he's a very outspoken champion about what the In Bloom model has done for Arroyo Grande. If you've been to the village of Arroyo Grande recently, you just notice how beautiful and well kept it is, and we're hoping to attain that same kind of look and feel in Morro Bay.
Again, it's not a government entity. There is no tax dollars used at all. There is no labor expense.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, it's a nonprofit organization. We're incorporated as a nonprofit, and America in Bloom is a nonprofit organization. Now, this is all people power. It's all volunteer, and it's tremendous. You know, at the end of our two-hour sessions, to look around and actually see what we've accomplished, it really does put a smile on everyone's face.
Mm-hmm. Looking forward here in Morro Bay, what are some of your long-range plans?
Oh, we have We have lots of plans, and I think that will sustain us. That's what draws people to the organization. We are looking forward to our 50th anniversary of incorporation as a city. So we're looking to spiff up the gateways to town so that Morro Bay is putting its best foot forward on its 50th anniversary. And we have some other interesting things in the works in the way of public art. We'd like to kind of venture a little bit more into the public art arena. We have some ideas. Those are kind of top secret at the time right now, but everybody should stay tuned and keep their eyes on Morro Bay for some interesting presentations of public art coming in 2014.
Back to the plantings. What percentage of the plants and how great an emphasis is placed on indigenous plantings?
Oh, very much so. I mean, it's, I would say, you know, we haven't really done anything in the way of you know, perennial or annual color that isn't native so far. I mean, we might get into an area, I can foresee a time when, you know, we're doing some seasonal plantings and we're doing some annual plantings, but right now everything is native.
How about IDing the plants themselves so that, say, if I'm walking downtown and I go, wow, what a cool plant, how do I find out what that plant is called and where I get it?
Well, you know, that is really a great idea. I mean, so far with the library and with the chamber, we've had, you know, plant lists that we have worked from. That is something that I could foresee us putting on a website or actually putting near the plants themselves as we go along. That's a great suggestion. At the very least, we should be able to put our plant lists on our projects up on our website, which is under construction right now.
Mm-hmm. And the website name will be what?
It'll be morrobayinbloom.org. Mm-hmm. But like so many other things, it's under construction right now. We're only 2 months old at this point, so it's been an intense period of multitask to get this up and going.
If somebody was listening and they thought, oh gosh, I'd like to get involved in that, what's the process? How do they contact you or the organization right now?
Well, an email can be sent to morrobayinbloom@gmail.com, and we'll send you news of our monthly schedule and where we're going to be. We try to stay about 4 weeks ahead of time with respect to our schedule so that people know where we're going to be. Generally speaking, right now, it has been Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. That's when we work. That's what we may expand or change that at some point, but right now, we just want some consistency. So it's every Saturday from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. And if people want to know where we're going to be next, it would be morrobayinbloom@gmail.com.
Right. And right now, how many people typically show up for a work party?
It has really been remarkable. I mean, we've had as many as 25. We've had as few as 10. What we do is we then tailor the activities so that people have a sense of achievement and accomplishment during 2 hours. So our on-site people are very good at determining workflow and what people are capable of doing, so that at the end of the 2 hours, we can look around and say, wow, we really accomplished something, and we retain more our volunteers that way.
Excellent. Walter Heath, we're out of time. Otherwise, we'd go on and on. This has been delightful. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Tom.
We've been speaking with Walter Heath, who represents Morro Bay in Bloom. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Morro Bay.
And you're listening to Issues and Ideas on Public Radio KCBX. Still to come on today's program, Ears on Art presents its 14th annual holiday program featuring stories told by members from the community. But up first, we learn about a group of dedicated volunteers that work hard at the long-term management and restoration of the Elfin Forest in Los Osos.
I'm Marisa Waddell with you on Issues and Ideas. There's a small 90-acre nature preserve in Los Osos that's home to a huge number and variety of plants and animals, and that attracts scientists from all over to study its inhabitants and its environment. It was slated for development in the 80s, but a group of dedicated volunteers worked hard to save the land. It's the El Morro Elfin Forest, just on the edge of the Morro Bay mudflats and salt marsh. My guest today is Ron Rasmussen, who's the board chair of the group that saved and cares for the Elfin Forest. That's the Small Wilderness Area Preservation, or SWAP. Ron is also the chair of SWAP's Conservation Committee. Welcome, Ron.
Thanks very much.
Well, it's good to have you. I'd like to know, first off, what is so special about the Elfin Forest?
Well, the specialness derives from where it is and how it was formed. It sits on top of a big sand dune that was formed probably more than 10,000 years ago during the last ice age. And at that time, the sea level was much lower, so the prevailing northwest wind was able to pick up sand from along the beach in the ocean and pile it up. Los Osos has a lot of sand in it as well.
It sure does.
If you live there. And that's how the sand migrated to where it is.
So it's a relatively young place, geologically speaking.
Geologically speaking, it's very young, yes. When the sea level came back up, the deposition of sand stopped on these sand dunes, and vegetation moved in. The uniqueness about the Elfin Forest is that the vegetation varies depending on where in the Elfin Forest it's growing.
Mm-hmm.
On the south edge, for instance, it is exposed directly to the sun, and the ground or the sand is very dry. So what you get there is what's called coastal dune scrub.
Mm-hmm.
And the plants there that you, if you go and visit, you'll notice they are widely separated. But if you go a little farther and go up the hill and down the other side to the north-facing slope, the plants, difference is dramatic because the plants that grow there get moisture from the ocean, and they are able to grow much better. They grow more close together, and there you see the oaks.
And what about the animals? I understand there are all kinds of birds and mammals and reptiles, too, in the Elfin Forest.
Yes. One of the highlights in terms of animals is the birds, because at any one time, if you go with an experienced birder, and he or she will be able to identify them, within a space of about 2 hours or so, you can get up to 70, 80 species just walking around the boardwalk.
Just in one visit?
In one visit, right.
My goodness.
Now, you won't see 80 or 90, but you'll have to take the word of the birder.
You can hear them.
yeah, you can hear them.
I understand that the Elfin Forest is a part of a bird sanctuary and is on the Pacific Coast Flyway, and it's definitely a destination where lots of people come to watch birds and count birds.
That's really true. And the best time for seeing this large number of species is actually in October. They have what's called a big sit.
Mm-hmm.
And under that rubric, I guess that's the word, a group of birders will come into the Elfin Forest and sit in one spot for 24 hours and see how many birds they can identify, either by sight or sound. And this last year, I think they got about 105 species.
Wow. And the birding is actually great all year round, but especially good October through, say, January or February?
Right, yes. That's the migratory period for birds.
So right now, if you're a bird person or you want to be a bird person, this is a good time to go visit the Elfin Forest.
Yeah, it's the birds that are most prominent migrating are the ducks and geese and so on.
So the Elfin Forest is owned by three different entities, isn't that right?
That's correct.
So County Parks, and who else?
County Parks owns about 38 acres. State Park owns the section to the north, which is about 40-odd acres. And then there's a little piece on the far west end that's owned by the California State Lands Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't explain why that is true, but it is. What the situation is then that the State Parks people and the State Lands Commission have apparently have made an agreement with the county that the county should take care of it. And the county's agent for taking care of it is SWAP.
SWAP. You guys. Okay. So part of your mission then is caring for the Elfin Forest.
That's right, for the whole thing.
What does that involve? And why does anybody need to take care of it?
Well, one of the major things when we moved in, well, there were actually two major areas that needed attention when SWAP took over. One was the presence of invasive weeds. One prominent one was belt grass. You may or may not know what belt grass is, but if you don't know what it is, all you have to do is drive down a street in Los Osos and you'll find some.
It's a reddish bunch grass.
Right. And the other thing is people misusing the elfin forest. And believe it or not, the kids on their off-road vehicles had actually built a race course.
I remember it when I was a kid playing in the elfin forest and ducking ATVs and motorcycles.
Yeah. So to deal with those two things has taken years, literally decades.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Marisa Waddell, and my guest today is Ron Rasmussen, who's the board chair of Small Wilderness Area Preservation, or SWAP, that cares for and saved the Elfin Forest in Los Osos. Tell me a little bit more about your personal involvement with SWAP. Why are you involved, and why is it important to you?
Well, the basic reason is that I retired from the University of California at Irvine in 97, and I found a place to live that I really liked in Morro Bay, so I moved up here, and then I discovered, what am I going to do now? And it just, not by chance, but by deliberate searching for something to do, I became associated with Small Wilderness Area Preservation. And this offered a way to continue the work that I had been doing at the university.
Because, and what work was that?
Environmental toxicology, which is a big name for dealing with environmental problems, either pollution or whatever. And by going into the Elfin Forest and working there, many of the same problems exist in the Elfin Forest.
Where does SWAP get the funding to care for the Elfin Forest?
One of the sources is our loyal membership. And we have a paid membership of about 350, which in terms of environmental agencies is pretty small membership group. But remember, this is just the membership that is focused on the Elfin Forest. With respect to larger projects, we have got grants from the National Estuary Program. The Morro Bay National Estuary Program has funds available for projects that relate to preservation of the estuary. And since the Elfin Forest sits right on the edge of the estuary, it's important to keep that elfin forest from being a source of pollution to the end of the estuary. And one source of pollution is dogs. And so with support from the National Estuary Program, we have installed a mutt-mitt program. And so at every entrance to the elfin forest, there's a box with little green bags that dog owners can pick up and pick up after their pets.
I'm always surprised how often I come across someone just letting their dog go and then leaving it behind. And I'm wondering if there's a misunderstanding that people have that it's biodegradable, it's part of nature, and it's okay.
I think that's one attitude that people have. It's difficult to do much about it because, first of all, the Elfin Forest is so small in relation to other county parks. In other words, it doesn't get a big slice of the attention that the county parks may be able to use in other areas. Some of the neighbors that live near the Elfin Forest just don't care. And they let their dogs out in the morning from their house, and the dog goes into the Elfin Forest and runs around. I'm a little bit surprised that we haven't had more interaction between these dogs and the coyotes. Because coyotes will mate with dogs. And either it doesn't matter what the sex of the dog is either. If the dog is a male, then the female coyote will make overtures, you know. And the other way around, if the dog is a female, then the male coyotes will go after her. In addition to that, if you should encounter a coyote in the Elfin Forest, don't run, because they will, you know, they will think you're, well, maybe we should follow that guy. Maybe we can get a bite. Make believe that you're a big animal and, you know, just stare it down. And eventually they will go and mind their own business.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Marisa Waddell, and I'm talking with Ron Rasmussen, who's the board chair of Small Wilderness Area Preservation that saved and cares for the Elephant Forest in Los Osos. What kind of help does SWAP need?
One of the things that we're going to need is more board members. The board members are getting along in years, and we can't go on forever.
So you need some young blood on the...
We need young blood, right.
Mm-hmm. And how about other kinds of volunteer efforts? How can someone become involved with the Elephant Forest?
Well, we have a monthly, what's called, I call it a work day, the first Saturday of every month. We ask that people who would like to do some work in the Elephant Forest show up at the end of 15th Street in Los Osos about 9 o'clock in the morning on the first Saturday of the month, and you'll be able to join a work party, and we do all kinds of interesting things. I think I call them interesting things, all the way from erosion control to weed control and boardwalk repair, whatever needs to be done.
So if someone wants more information about the Elephant Forest or Small Wilderness Area Preservation, how does one find that?
Go to our website, and you will learn more than probably you ever wanted to know. It's elephant-forest.org. Don't forget the hyphen.
Okay, elephant-forest.org.
Right, that's correct.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Ron, for being with me this afternoon. Ron Rasmussen, the chair of the board of Small Wilderness Area Preservation that preserved and cares for the El Moro Elephant Forest in Los Osos.
Thank you.
For Issues and Ideas, I'm Marisa Waddell.
And this is Issues and Ideas on Public Radio KCBX. Support for KCBX comes from the Basin Street Regulars, the Central Coast Hot Jazz Society, presenting America's music at the Pismo Beach Fets Hall. Complete information is available at pismojazz.com. Coming up at 2 o'clock, it's On Being with Krista Tippett. Emerging church elder Phyllis Tickle and civil rights veteran Vincent Harding join Krista Tippett in an honest and sometimes politically incorrect conversation on coming to terms with racial identity in the church and in the world. That's On Being at 2 o'clock. But up next on today's Issues and Ideas, Ears on Art presents its 14th annual holiday program. Ears on Art is sponsored by Marshall's Jewelers, creating and selling fine jewelry since 1889. You can visit them on the corner of Hygera and Garden Streets in downtown San Luis Obispo.
Red tulips, an iPod, and a lullaby. Stay tuned. Good afternoon. Issues and Ideas continues now with Ears on Art, a twice-monthly segment which is produced here at the studios of KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. I am Chrissy Hewitt, and with my co-host Stephen DeLuque, we create this program which focuses on the visual arts. This month, we take a slight detour and do what we have done for the previous 13 years, and present stories written and read by local community members. The theme this year, The Gift is in the Details. With 7 stories to tell, we're going to begin right away. Here now is Lindsay Wilcox.
I hate this place. I was sobbing once again on the phone to my brother. I was a suburban California girl in New York City for art school. I had been there for 3 months. It was just before Christmas, and I was still completely overwhelmed. I loved cities, but this was something else entirely. In the early 90s, NYC was still very rough around the edges. Everyone seemed so mean, and they were in your face all the time. Cabbies yelling obscenities and honking sirens, pushy people on the subway, trash, dirt, noise, noise, noise. This suburban gal was getting licked. My school, the Art Students League, was everything I had hoped it would be. It was full of tradition and wonderful characters. It was my haven. I would manage to make it through the whole week of class, Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. However overwhelmed I was by the big city, I managed to slog my way through it and up the school steps every Monday. Once I got back to my apartment Friday evenings, however, I'd barely leave until it was time for class again Monday morning. Flash forward 3 more months to early March. I felt somewhat less shell-shocked, but I wouldn't have said my adjustment to the city was complete. My brother had finally been able to squeeze time out of his schedule to come to commiserate. He was a student at the Culinary Institute of America in Poughkeepsie, New York, known to chefs everywhere as the CIA. His school schedule was more rigorous than mine. His visit was quite the act of charity. We were having a stroll along 57th Street down from my school. It was a freezing silver day. We were heading to my new haven, the IBM building at 57th and Madison Avenue. It had an enclosed atrium, stories high. Free to the public, it was ringed with pretty little shops, dotted with ever-changing garden plantings, had a small cafe and plenty of benches to sit and enjoy it all. It was both grand and intimate, and even better, was always cozy and warm. To my surprise, this day it was awash in deep red tulips. All the planting beds were full of them. Their joyous red was a complete contrast to the bleak day and was nothing short of breathtaking. My brother and I sat on a bench and started to talk of the city and my work to make a life in it. After a while, I became aware of a distressing state of affairs. There were gardeners working quietly around us, removing tulip plants. They were being unceremoniously dumped into wheelbarrows. Oh, dear, I thought. I just couldn't believe that they were being taken in their prime like this. My brother and I continued to talk, but underneath I felt sad for those flowers, and probably more than a bit for myself. This town just wouldn't let me savor one place in peace. I held out small hope the tulips had some further life, as cut flowers, maybe. I asked one of the gardeners as he passed, what would happen to all the tulips? He paused briefly and made a wordless reply, a deliberate thumbs down. I'm sure I looked fairly stricken, but he didn't seem to notice. He just walked back to his work without showing any reaction to mine. How perfect a symbol of the harshness of this big, bad city. I had to suffer injustices to life and beauty, even in my newest haven. I was young and dramatic that way. And then they were there, a large bouquet of the reddest, happiest tulips I had ever seen, floating in front of my face. I hadn't noticed anyone approaching. I lifted my face, taking in the details of the scene. The hand holding the flowers was a bit rough and had dirt under the fingernails. I scanned up and saw the face. It was my gardener, the dour fellow who relayed the coming demise of the beautiful flowers. His expression softened only ever so slightly as he said, I think these will be good for a while. He handed them to me and was gone, walking the same measured pace as before back to his work. I was still stunned as I watched him walk away. I looked down at the flowers and paused. Then the tears came. Happy ones this time. I grinned and looked my brother full in the face and with no qualms said, I love this place. He laughed in return. In that moment, I knew I was and would always be, in some way, a New Yorker.
My name is Dorothy Pitkin. I live here on the Central Coast. I've retired from a mental health position, but I'm still working partly at the community counseling center and also with a few clients doing psychotherapy and embodied imagination, which is a way of working with dreams, memories, and symptoms. I moved to Washington State when I was 22. I was working at a minimum wage job and had no way of celebrating the holidays with my family. I quickly learned that decorating my apartment helped my mood, and my parents sent me my stocking and the regular stocking stuffers as well every year that I was away. In our family, stocking stuffers ranged from toothpaste and chapstick to a roll of quarters. My friends found it very amusing that each item was so carefully wrapped in Christmas paper. being away meant for me that I had no expectations for what my parents would choose to send. I would receive the package and just enjoy that symbol that they were thinking of me. I never opened the box early. I savored the gift as it was when it arrived, unknown and just welcome. When Christmas Day arrived, I sat next to my tree and slowly opened each item. Most years, my mother would send something like new slippers, and my father would send a book or sometimes music. One year, I finished going through my package of presents and was returning the wrapping paper to the box when I noticed one stocking stuffer was still unopened. It was a small cardboard tube such as comes in a roll of paper towels. I stopped to open it and found a finely embroidered picture of a basket full of vegetables that had been sent rolled around its dowels, ready to hang on my kitchen wall. I was overwhelmed by the love represented by the many hours of careful stitching that my mother put into making this gift for me. For all of that, it had almost been completely overlooked. I would not have missed it, neither have expected it, nor having seen it being made. It was important to my mother to make and send it. Even the memory of the shock of finding such a special gift in such a humble package warms me with the awareness of how loved I am.
Hi, everybody. My name is Rory Weber, and this story is called Tiny Metal Wafer. I suppose there's no beating around the bush here. It's about my iPod. However, it's also about how sometimes material goods, that is value and reward exceeding that of the object itself. In hindsight, I probably should have expected getting it. After blasting bombastic soundtracks from the computer for 3 solid months, much to the chagrin of the other household members, they probably decided some alternative was necessary. Yet I am dumbfounded on Christmas when I lift the tissue paper out and see it resting in the bottom of the box. Says I to myself, well, there goes the status quo. It's lavender, smaller than a pink pearl eraser, and nestled in the middle of a mess of wire I recognize as its cradle. Don't misunderstand, I was happy to own a personalized musical device of this nature, a definite step up from my Walkman and headphones of old. But, much like a second grader sitting down in front of the school computer for the first time, I couldn't help but be a little daunted by it. Even so, I gradually hit the learning curve over the next few weeks, figuring out how to sync the iPod, buy songs, and arrange playlists. In about a month, I've built up a small audio library of soundtracks. A Saturday night, 12:04 a.m. I sit in front of the computer, buds jammed tightly in my ears, seething quietly. On the screen, an Audacity editing layout is ballooned up to full size. This has become a regular occurrence. Wait until the house quiets down, and then fiddle with sound files until reaching some desired effect, then importing them into iTunes. There are only a handful of instances where I've stayed up this late doing it, though, or been this frustrated with it. The objects of my exasperation are a pair of musical tracks in the Transformers movie, known as Decepticons and the Allspark. Repeated listening has engendered the realization that they are each segments of a larger, bifurcated track, which I have been attempting to edit together for a while now. Much of the problem stems from the fact that part of the audio from the tail end of Decepticons seems to repeat at the beginning of Allspark, making editing a chore. After playing the tracks backwards as a sort of cooldown while I let my anger dissipate, I return my attention to the problem at hand. Whenever I strike the few seconds of silence off the end of Decepticons, a tiny, almost imperceptible sliver of discordant noise remains. It's the sort of infuriating triviality first-world problems are made of. Cranking up the volume, I listened intently to it several times. The problem, I gradually realize, isn't Decepticons, nor is it a case of repeating audio. Instead, the silent portion is the very first part of The Allspark, a track I had always assumed started up immediately. I select the offending area and press delete, hoping fervently it will work. It does. A Monday, approximately 11:20 a.m. In physics class, our teacher puts us to work on the Big Quarter Project, a trebuchet constructed primarily out of cardboard. One of the students, an outgoing fellow named John, has taken to playing music over an ancient pair of speakers in the workshop. However, he's forgotten his iPhone today. I don't know what prompts me to speak up, but I offer mine to him, asking him if he's favorably partial to soundtracks. He responds enthusiastically, and I warn him that some of the music on my iPod is pretty strange. John laughs and tells me that's fine. He plugs it in. Immediately, a leitmotif known as Frenzy sounds through the speakers. Not my favorite, but John seems to like it. As we cut away and slather on glue, a section heavily dominated by orchestra sets in. I become aware of a small layer of sweat settling on my face as self-consciousness rears its head. I really don't want to come across as a pretentious twit, affecting a semblance of sophistication, what's such fair. The iPod cycles all the way through to prime before the period is out. As we clean up, I disconnect it and slip it into my pocket. I quietly write off the endeavor as a failure, until I overhear two classmates talking later in the day. It was, like, the perfect music for Halit's class. Yeah, better than the Disney stuff earlier. The next day, I ask John if he would like to listen to more songs, and he agrees. As I plug in the jack, I wonder if what they say about material items not being a source of true pleasure is true or not. Probably not, I muse, but then another proverb occurs to me. The joy is in the little things.
You're tuned in to Ears on Art here on KCBX Public Radio. Today's program is our 14th annual holiday storytelling. Members of the community are sharing thoughts about the theme, The Gift is in the Details.
I'm Kate Froman. I've lived in San Luis Obispo since 1972 and love living in this little piece of paradise. I have friends and family here and have been a partner with KCBX for many years. A father's gift. I never really knew my father. He was a quiet alcoholic who spent his days working in a factory and his nights drinking wine in his bedroom. I don't remember him ever eating a meal with us at the table, crowded with my sisters and brother, or asking me anything about my life. But I do remember the Christmas morning when I was 5 years old. I had just unwrapped a doll wearing a dress and a bonnet, and I was standing in front of the icebox, not a refrigerator, talking with my mother. My father, whom I called Poppy, as did all my siblings, shuffled out of his room and came up to me. He noticed my doll, and he asked to hold it. I handed it to him, and he cuddled it like an infant. That was a surprise in itself. But then he proceeded to sing what I many years later discovered was an Irish lullaby called Tura Lura Lural. He sang it while rocking my doll. I was shocked, a little bewildered, and most of all, amazed at the sweetness and tenderness in his voice and manner. Then he handed the doll back to me and disappeared into his room. I don't remember my mother or me talking about this, but while writing this memoir, I went to YouTube and listened to a woman singing this lullaby and was transported back to hearing my father's voice and feeling a bit of the gentle essence of him. Poppy's mother came to the United States from Ireland as a young woman, and she worked as a maid. Her name was Mary Durgan. And I think she must have sung this lullaby to Poppy as her mother had sung it to her. My father's gift, a lullaby sung to a little girl's doll, is my connection to him and his mother. The memory is bittersweet, but like dark chocolate, it is good.
My name is Josephine Lang. Chrissa Hewitt and I have been friends for more than 30 years. Today I'd like to share with you a story from my forthcoming book, Step Into Magic, which is both a memoir and a practical guide for developing your psychic ability, deepening your spirituality, and finding your own true purpose. Now, here is the true account of what happened to me when I was a very young woman. I was only 19 when my mother died. Innocently, I answered the phone only to be utterly destroyed by her physician explaining that she was gone. I fell into uncontrollable grief. I would not be consoled. My father's secretary heard me from the office upstairs and came down to my side to try to break through my wailing and comfort me, but I couldn't be reached. Part of me felt I was not even in my body. I seemed to be just quietly watching myself from slightly above. My grandmother, Noni, was called and arrived shortly. In her wisdom, she simply gathered me up and took me outside to walk among the great trees that grew along the shore of the little lake below our home. There, out in nature, on that still day, with high clouds overhead, her quiet and loving words began to wash over and through me. After a while, my grief toned down to a steady weeping. But still, I was incapable of imagining how I could exist without the loving presence of my mother in my life. As we walked, I tried to listen to what my grandmother had to say, in hopes that she could show me a way that would enable me to carry on. But it all seemed so useless, and I kept being distracted by the sound of something that I couldn't see up in the tops of those very tall trees. There, in the quiet sky, I could hear and feel subtle gusts of wind being pushed downward by what seemed like large birds. Periodically, I would glance up and scowl, a little annoyed at hearing and feeling something while not being able to see anything up in the branches. At one point, as I looked up, my grandmother paused and asked, "Darling, what is it that you keep looking at up there?" I replied that I didn't know, but it seemed like there were huge birds up there, only I couldn't see any. She caught a little breath. Then, with a sweet look of deep knowing, she said, "Ah, that would be the angels." And with that, I looked again, and though I couldn't see them with my eyes, high overhead, another part of me saw 5 or 6 of them. They were very large, maybe 20 feet long, with enormous wingspans, circling above us, invisible, yet somewhat gossamer. I could still distinctly feel and hear the great movement of air caused by their wings. They seemed to circle a few times more as I stood lost in awe and wonder. Then they rose higher and gathered together and flew off over the water toward the east. That moment rekindled in me a sense of wonder and joy, and most importantly, my desire for life. For that short bit of time, I completely forgot my grief. Deep within, I knew that those angels had not only come for me, but they had also come for my mother, and that all would be well with her, as it would also be well for me. Then I watched as they flew away. The further they got, the more clearly I could see them. By the time they reached the distant horizon, they looked like great silvery birds, almost lost in the big sky. When they were gone, my grandmother stroked my hand. We looked deeply into each other's eyes and smiled. With a great calm and the joy of truth in my heart, I knew that I could go on. I knew that in time I would be able to heal my grief. So we turned and headed home.
Hi, my name's Susan. I've lived in San Luis Obispo County for about 35 years. Mom said I was the ugliest baby she ever laid her eyes on. Well, actually, she said I wasn't a very pretty baby. My mom's kind in that way. Because truth be told, when my mom said I wasn't a very pretty baby, translated meant I was born an ugly baby. Mom's opinion held some weight because my mom was a registered nurse, and for a time she worked as a labor and delivery nurse. Mom saw lots of babies, pretty ones and ugly ones. There's usually no middle ground when it comes to judging the looks of a baby. My little sister, whom I love more than life itself, works as a labor and delivery nurse in Los Angeles. She refers to ugly babies as precious. She would say, "Oh, your baby's so precious." Translated meant, "Oh, your baby's so ugly." My sister's kind in that way, like my mom. Pretty babies, to my little sister, on the other hand, are referred to as pretty babies. For me to have been one of the ugliest babies Mom ever laid her eyes on, I must have been something awful to look at. I've seen pictures of me as a baby, and I don't think I look so bad. Well, one photograph in particular, I looked pretty ugly. Yep, downright precious, I suppose. But I think that was because of the camera angle. I was positioned in such a way that my eyes appear crossed. Not that that's ugly, but I think it was the camera angle. Because other than that, I look like a typical baby. Round and squishy. Okay, I suppose I was born a precious baby. There was a picture of me when I was about 2 years old. The camera was much more favorable to me. I think I was holding a little stuffed toy rabbit. The picture was in black and white, and it was hand-tinted. The hand-tinted print added subtle colors to my cheeks and lips. I was downright cute in that picture, if I do say so myself.
Well, anyway, when I was growing up, for the longest time, I thought I was adopted. Not that there's anything wrong with being adopted. One reason I believed that so strongly was that everyone in my family were born Purdy. I was the only precious baby in the whole bunch. Another reason I gave myself for being adopted was that I had green eyes. Everyone in my family had beautiful blue eyes, but not me. My two green eyes had to have come from my biological parents, not from the two, blue-eyed, pretty when they were babies, adults raising me. The blue-eyed family that adopted me must have seen me as a precious baby and took pity on me. How else could I have gotten stuck with green eyes when everyone else got pretty blue eyes? And how could it have been possible to be born so ugly when everyone else in the family were born pretty? The most natural conclusion was obvious to me. I had to be adopted. Growing up helps put things in their proper place. Just because I was born precious, and no one else in my family was, that was not reason enough to think I was adopted. I have realized that over time some people grow into their preciousness and become quite attractive in their own right. Others do not. A wise saying my mom always used to say was, "Pretty is pretty does." Now that saying worked out pretty good for me. Today I'm all grown up with my green eyes and loving my natural blue-eyed parents with all my heart. The deep lines that this old life has given to me on my face and in my character are easily seen as I approach 50. After all is said and done, for those of us born into this old world a precious baby, and those born downright pretty, it's not what you look like on the outside. It's what you are on the inside that truly matters the most.
My mom had an amazing ability to transform the smallest of things into something much more. Growing up, I helped my mom create almost all of her large fiber art projects. I would make handmade cattail paper that was later transformed into large wall hangings, or weave hand-painted window screen strips through wire mesh to make her largest sculptures. During most of my afternoons when she was not driving me to violin lessons, she would drag me into the local hardware store to pick up odd objects or drive country roads until we came upon a patch of wild cattails. Off she would send me to pick as many as I could before any cars went by to make pulp for her paper. I would always ask questions like, "Mom, what are you going to do with these things?" And she would say, "I don't know yet. It'll come to me." These statements would frustrate me because I wanted to know she had a master plan for all that time I spent working with her. Now I find myself saying the same thing when I'm whipping up a creation in the kitchen for my family, because there is no recipe for creativity, and whatever your medium is, improvisation is king. Early on, before she was focused on singular projects like the butterflies, she would always create as the mood struck her. One of my favorite pieces, which now hangs by my kitchen, is a weaving made entirely out of men's ties from the 70s. My mom and dad were traveling across the country, and every now and then, they would stop by a Goodwill where she would keep finding strange ties for really cheap. Upon collecting them, she started to weave and found a pinup girl inside one of the ties. That became the centerpiece of the weaving. Art then becomes about found objects, happened upon by chance, and put together to create a larger message. What I didn't realize as a child, and that I do now, is that my mom was giving me the creative tools necessary to apply in any way I wanted later in life. The afternoons I spent weaving, making paper, and gathering materials from the natural world morphed into something uniquely mine as a nutritionist, cook, and a florist. My brother has transformed into a doctor, technological genius, and a loving uncle. Both me and my brother, Rita Tate and Jamie Kirkpatrick, have taken her creative energy and applied it in our own way in the field of health. My mom also gave this gift to my lovely daughters, Lorelai and Veronica. They always look forward to their grandmother's visits, as they always included lessons on nature and art. My mom's gift to the world was one of creativity and improvisation with the materials you have on hand. I believe that anyone who benefited from this lesson she gave is truly blessed, and this is what she would have wanted her legacy to be. My name is Rita Tate, and my mother, Janine Kirkpatrick, who passed away on October 24th, and who had her memorial on Sunday, November 24th, has her art on exhibit in the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art until December 29th. She completed a series of pastels entitled Rare and Endangered Butterflies.
Indeed, as a teacher and as an artist, Janine Kirkpatrick was a valuable part of the Central Coast art community, and she will be deeply missed. The participants in today's annual storytelling were Lindsay Wilcox, Dorothy Pitkin, Rory Weber, Kate Froman, Josephine Lang, Susan Lopez, and Rita Tate. You have been listening to Ears on Art, produced here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. Stephen DeLuque and I will be back next week with part two of our 14th annual holiday program, featuring stories written and read by members of the community. The theme again, the gift is in the details. I am Chrissy Hewitt. Thank you so much for listening.